Full Story is supported by Telstra. Big ambitions need the right partner, and that's where Telstra comes in. Telstra works with enterprise and government organisations across Australia to help them build, connect, and grow at scale. They support real outcomes, from secure business growth to connecting schools to networks that help keep communities safe. Telstra is a long-term partner for organisations with complex needs and big plans. Together builds better, wherever they go. For enterprise-sized solutions, partner with Telstra.
This is The Guardian.
I'm Barry Cassidy.
And I'm Tony Barry.
Welcome to Back to Back Barry's, a podcast from Guardian Australia. Well, the impact of the Iran war is becoming clearer for all to see. The lack of a clear strategy, the lack of clear objectives, the blocking of the Strait of Hormuz, which has caused all sorts of difficulties, and as a result, the economic cost threatening the global economy. The government is now talking out loud about an inflation rate above 5%, maybe softening up the country for more increases in interest rates, and all the while, petrol in a lot of places now is reaching $2.50 a litre, where you can get it. So that's the wash-up after 3 weeks of a war that the government and the opposition supported, but it turns out most of you, the people of Australia, did not. There was a Resolve poll that showed only 28% of Australians supported the war. In other words, only 28% supported the government's endorsement, Tony.
Yeah, I was actually surprised it was that high, and I think it was interesting that Hasty is sort of starting to distance himself between the Trumpian view of the world, which I think is really interesting, and we might come back to that later. But Trump is just stepping on his own landmines now, and it's going to be interesting because, yeah, there are still some, notionally intelligent people who think Trump is playing this sort of 5D chess and the rest of us are playing checkers. But I think, the last week has shown that this guy is completely out of his depth. And when he comes up against international political heavyweights like Netanyahu and Putin, they play him off a break, is what I've noticed. But he's awful to his friends. The Japanese Prime Minister, well, I thought those comments where she was in the Oval Office with him and he talked about Pearl Harbor.
You want a surprise? What about Pearl Harbor? That was a surprise.
Yeah. He wouldn't talk like that to Putin. But it's now obvious that, he's been played off a break. He's now sets course on this path and none of us know where it ends and what the end looks like.
The author Geraldine Brooks wrote a piece for the Nine newspapers during the week, and I think a lot of what she said would pick up on that the sentiment that's expressed in that poll, that she gave Albanese the benefit of the doubt in his dealings with Trump up until this point. But now with this war, with no legal basis, no clear objective, she just thinks it's reached that point where you wonder what is going on. When you talk about Netanyahu being, he's shrewd, there's no doubt about that. The way that he had launched that attack on a key facility, the biggest facility, energy facility in Iran, and I don't think it bothered him one little bit about the argument that followed about whether the America was notified or whether they needed their permission or not. And the best Trump could come up with was, well, he said he won't do it again. It's done. It's like the sense that they would walk away from this and saying, well, an 86-year-old is dead and therefore, we win. It's the experience with Hamas is, the dead, like Hamas fighters, become martyrs and the rest of them fight on. And so I think that was probably obvious a week or two ago, but what is now obvious is the Strait of Hormuz, that Trump has not got the answers and he found himself isolated when he looked for support.
Yeah. I suspect there will be a coalition of the unwilling in the end. I know that a lot of countries have said they're not going to get involved in it, but I think ultimately, they've got us over a barrel, pun unintended, because if we want to open up, those energy supplies – other countries are going to probably have to get involved, I suspect. And I see there's been a bit of movement from other international leaders now who originally rejected his overtones, but it's going to be very difficult to navigate in terms of global economic consequences. And, you know, we're reaching that point where, you know, the ramifications could continue for years.
You know, it was, I think the German Chancellor put it best. He probably echoed most of the sentiments around the world, because this is a country, the United States and Donald Trump, who boast, we have the most powerful military in the world. There's nothing that we can't do. And then suddenly he's going cap in hand, looking for support to keep a strait open. The German Chancellor says there was never a joint decision to intervene. The Iranian regime must come to an end, but based on all experiences going back decades, bombing it into submission is not the right approach. And his defence minister said, this is not our war. We have not started it. I'm sure that's a popular view, and a lot of people would be saying, just ordinary citizens in the street were saying, well, you started it if you haven't got the might to deal with it. And as for the coalition of the unwilling, it may come to that in a way, but I don't think too many of them will put their hardware and their ships in harm's way, and certainly not their troops.
It'll be purely on economic motivations, certainly no allegiance to America or any trust in Donald Trump, who I think has obliterated that with middle-ranking powers and his allies, more generally speaking. So the trick will be in terms of, you know, when you're talking about what does the end look like, I think for Iran, yeah, one of the golden rules of politics, whether it be domestic or international, is to give a pathway back for your opponents. So they can do a strategic retreat. And in the case of Iran, if they've got nothing to lose, they'll just go scorched earth, which they're actually in the process of doing, and they'll just, you know, blow up all the supply chains for energy, and they'll massive ramifications for the economy, which Trump doesn't seem to have thought ahead. And that is I think, you know, when it comes to how does Trump engineer it so that Iran, you know, reaches some sort of settlement and opens up these energy sources. I mean, the only real offering will have to include Israel, because that's their true enemy. And I can't see any realistic offering that Trump can give them that involves Israel.
Yeah, and he's got to get their approval ahead of time. Look, just sticking with me on this one, but I was just reading a book, Ian Fleming's biography, the author of the Bond books during the week for a book club. There was references, quite a few references in that, to the Suez Crisis in 1956 when Fleming was involved in espionage and so on for the British government. It struck me that there were some remarkable comparisons and similarities between that and the Strait of Hormuz now. The most striking is that it was led by Britain with Israel support when they invaded Egypt because Egypt wanted to nationalise the canal, opposed by the UN and opposed by the US. And now you get this situation 70 years later, the Strait of Hormuz is the reverse. You've got America again with Israel, against the UN, and effectively against Britain's view, certainly not getting the support that they want from Britain. So it's the reverse of that. But you know what's really interesting about it is that Australia, both times, was on the wrong side of history. We supported Britain when they were fading. They were humiliated by what went on in the Suez Canal. But we still saw them as a traditional ally, and we needed to be by them. And now again, the United States is losing all credibility around the world at a time when we're sticking with them on this one against Europe, against the better judgments of most of those in Europe. It just seems to me, you know, 70 years on, and that when you get the reverse situation. I wonder why then it is that the media pretty much leaves the government alone. They're having a go at them over the handling of the petrol crisis, and the economy is going to be a big one. But on this, on the fact that they backed the United States so early in the piece, not much. And I think it's partly because the media is still using a kind of an old-fashioned prism. They, if the major parties, if the coalition and Labor are at odds, it's controversial, it's an issue, they go for it. If they are in agreement, not so much. And I think that's out of date, because only about 50% of Australians now support those major parties anyway. That's another 50% that have got a view around this, and I pretty much know where that view would sit. It just seems that that they've got to break out of that kind of attitude that it's not a story unless the major parties are in conflict.
Yeah, and I think Hastie is picking up on this. You know, he yep. distanced himself from Trump. He's been talking about self-sufficiency for a long time, and you know, Chris Bowen has made an announcement to put more funding into the two existing refineries in operation in Australia. And that feeds into that narrative about being self-sufficient, which has been more pronounced in our research ever since COVID. But I think Hastie, this is the unorthodoxy of Hastie. And I reckon if Albanese, after the election, obviously he would have been feeling supremely confident about his campaign abilities and his political skills, rightly so, 94 seats, and breaking a lot of records along the way. I think his first choice for opposition leader, he would have preferred Angus Taylor. Good CV, but a guy in a suit, nothing different about that. I think Susan Lee would have been his second preference. And I think Hastie, his least preferred option.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Because he's just unorthodox. I think Albanese would absolutely back himself against Hastie, undoubtedly, for, you know, the confidence that he's got at the moment. But he would know that with Hastie there is, and I say this very carefully so I don't be sued for defamation, but he's got a bit of that Latham around him, the Latham pre-2004.
Too late, mention Latham. I'll sue you.
But it's that unorthodoxy, you know, that total unorthodoxy where, you know, Latham had Howard at sixes and sevens, you know, by making announcements and started dictating the flow.
He changed the whole superannuation system for politicians, Latham, from opposition.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Hastie is not coming out with the orthodox approach to these things, and he's recognising that Trump is not popular in Australia. He's recognising that Australians want to see more self-sufficiency, and he hasn't been afraid to take on Trump in the same way that Mark Carney in Canada, you know, really got hairy-chested with him as well.
Yeah, speaking of Canada, and I was talking about what happened with the Suez all those years ago, 70 years ago, Canada was chosen to lead the sort of negotiation to bring peace in that conflict. And he phoned the British Prime Minister and he said to him that if you don't get out of Egypt, we'll get out of the Commonwealth. Hmm. Now, that's Canada.
Yeah.
and they're a bit like that again. Yeah. Even now, they haven't lost that characteristic. What Hastie said, of course, was he accused Trump of being petulant. Hmm. Now, that's something that no member of the opposition, they haven't really criticised him in a personal sense in that way before. So it was quite significant. But just before we get to the economy, the other aspect of the war now that the government has to deal with, and that is petrol shortages, the price of petrol, whether people are being ripped off and so on. Chris Bowen, I thought, in the end explained it pretty simply. I mean, the proposition is simple enough, that we have the same amount of petrol overall in Australia that we would ordinarily have. There's no change to that. No ships have been blocked. But it's been selling at twice the rate that it normally would. So that's panic buying, right? Mm. Andrew Hastie's response to that was, well, here's Chris Bowen blaming you, the people. Well, I thought that was cheap politics, because how do you explain that situation, and it's true, without in effect blaming the people who have gone out and bought fuel that right at the moment anyway, they don't need?
Yep. I mean, I filled up with petrol this morning. It was like a scene from Mad Max. It was huge queues and very expensive prices. But I think, you know, we're at the moment in a blame culture, not an excuses culture. People want outcomes, and they're sick of excuses from both parties. And of course, closing down refineries has been basically a bipartisan approach for some time. The last two closed under Abbott, and there's two left. So I think, again, though, Hastie is recognising this play, and he's tapping into that sentiment out there.
Yeah. You talk about the blame game. I mean, within hours, of course, of the Bondi terrorist attack, Albanese was being blamed for it. And there was a willingness on the part of a lot to blame too early in the piece here anyway for the government for what's happening with the price of fuel. And there will be a close eye kept on it. But basically the strategy now is they've appointed a czar, in effect, somebody to oversee it. And then each state appoints a citizen, not a politician, to liaise with that person, right? So they've kind of handed it to the community, in a sense, to handle it. And I don't think that's just safeguarding themselves from sort of bulletproofing them for political attacks. I think it kind of makes sense because they're looking for people who are expert in the field.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, the blame culture that we're experiencing right now is precisely why Hanson is polling at 28%.
Yeah, and we'll get to that when we talk about South Australia shortly, and we'll certainly look at how this is impacting on the economy after we take a break. Just before I do, though, I just want to remind you again that we'll be recording back-to-back Barry's live at the Sydney Writers' Festival this year on Thursday, May 21st. I don't think I mentioned this last week, but it's a free event, and you don't need to book either. There's a big space, so you just rock up, you get yourself a coffee, and sit down and take it all in. Back in a moment.